Hi, this is Tim.
And I'm Wendy.
And welcome to our Foster Parenting Podcast.
We created this show to educate and inform our friends, family,
and anyone who wants to listen
about our lives as foster parents. So we watched a great movie the other night.
Yeah, it had lightsabers and Darth Vader.
No, not that one.
Oh, the one where the Millennium Falcon.
No. No, dear.
No, it was actually, yes, it was a great movie, and it didn't involve guns or lightsabers or lasers.
Wait, let's give some hints, and then the listeners at home can play along and, you know, see if they can guess it before we say the title.
Okay, well, it rhymes with Wirical Merker.
You don't know how to play this game. Hey, it's the miracle worker.
Why'd you give it away like that? They may not have gotten it.
I was going to say Anne Bancroft, Patty Duke, Black and White, About a Famous Person.
No, we got to cut to the chase here.
Okay, the miracle worker is about Helen Keller.
Yeah, and it's about the woman who helped Helen Keller communicate. If you don't know, Helen Keller was deaf and blind.
And it was just, I had never seen it before. It's a movie made in the early 60s, I think.
Wow, you'd never seen it before.
I had never seen the movie.
No. Wow. Well, it's a great movie, and if you haven't watched it, you should watch it. And it meant much more to us now that we are foster parents. So I guess Wendy had never seen it before, but it meant much more to me now that I am a foster parent, because I just so identified with the story of Annie Sullivan and what she was trying to do and how hard she had to fight for Helen Keller, who was fighting against her.
Right. And we recognized we never would have put this together had we not been foster parents, but we recognized that Helen Keller had reactive attachment disorder.
It makes total sense. If you can't communicate with the world and you are, I don't know, how old, 9, 10?
She was 6. Supposed to be 6.
Oh, okay.
Movie, I think.
The actress playing her is not 6. But...
Yeah, she was a teenager. Yeah, but they, you know, from what I've read of reactive attachment disorder, it doesn't just go with children who have been victims of abuse and neglect, but also like kids who are hospitalized for extended periods of time when they're young and, or, you know, had any kind of absence from their caregiver or, you know, in Helen Keller's case, couldn't communicate. So we just saw it all over. And there was this one scene in the dining room that it was kind of violent. Like Annie used some violence back towards Helen, you know, like Helen would slap her and she'd slap her back. And of course that's not what we identified with, but the feeling of desperation and the feeling of doing the same thing over and over and over until the child accepts it, that we got.
Yeah, it was reminiscent of spending over an hour to give a 4-minute timeout, or spending several hours to get Linda to stay in her bed.
Mm-hmm. And about 2 minutes into that scene, it's like a 10 minute scene,
yeah.
We started laughing out loud because we didn't even have to say it. We both realized this is our life.
I've done that.
Our life is right here. Yeah. So
we highly recommend the movie. And if you can't watch the movie, then we will post the scene. Somebody clipped it on YouTube and we'll show it to you. The only problem with the YouTube clip is that it cuts off the payoff line at the end. And it's this big scene of Annie trying to get Helen to use a spoon for breakfast, and she spends 4 hours working with her on using a spoon rather than her fingers, and at the end, she finally comes out of the room, and she says,
"The room is a wreck, but the napkin is folded." And that, right there, is the last 2 years of our lives with our children. The room is a wreck, but the napkin is folded.
Yeah, and The main point of the story, and it's not in the scene that we're including on the website, but the main theme of the movie was that pity wasn't the best thing for Helen. It was love, and love required doing some very hard things that Helen resisted, but she still worked hard to give those to her, despite her resistance to them.
Yeah, initially. Setting expectations and holding her to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Setting expectations and holding her to them.
Okay, well, moving on, since we've got a full show tonight.
Full show.
just wanted to mention the other day I was in the pool with Andrea and Linda, and Andrea had this little, just this little pool toy. It's like a stingray, at grandma's pool. She decided she was going to be the mom of the baby. And she asked me to come over and take care of the baby. And I asked, I said, okay, well, who am I? And she said, you're the birth mom. And I said, what are we going to do? And she said, you're going to take the baby for a sleepover.
Wow.
So I did. And, you know, not much interesting to the story beyond that, but just, I think it's the first time that I have seen her assign a birth mother in play. It was kind of interesting for me to be her.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of working things out there.
So.
And didn't your mom say something funny about the situation?
Yes. As soon as it started, she goes, I'm going to be hearing this on the podcast. So that's for you, Mom. So, Tim, everybody's been asking, how is our life different since the adoption?
Oh, my goodness. Well,
we've had 2 weeks.
First off, it's not at all different. And then...
it's not different.
There's nothing different. And then, yes. Yeah, there's nothing different. But there is this subtle quality, and it's hard to define and hard to pinpoint. And you pointed out, we're not sure if it's us or them or what, but there seems to be...
Or even other people.
Yeah, there's just seems to be this subtle, what's the word, recognition or greater attachment to us as mom and dad or permanency. Mm-hmm. And I see it in Linda more than Andrea, which is different for Linda. That's why I feel like there's something different, but it's hard to really pinpoint. I can't say that it's practically made our lives different.
Yeah. We are still certified foster parents. We went to a training the other night. You know, nothing's all that different, but yeah.
Oh, and trainings. Remember my rant about trainings?
No, but I'm sure you were saving it for the podcast.
Yeah, I was. Keep the train moving. This is my advice. We didn't talk about this beforehand. It's not in our notes, but it just struck me. Say, we've all got these mandatory meetings you got to go to, mandatory trainings.
Whether it's foster parenting or PTA or whatever.
Yeah, driver's ed,
work,
human resources. Mm-hmm. The instructor, you don't want to be there, but the instructor has to give you a certain set of information. Here's your job if you're going to those classes.
Keep the train moving.
You may not agree with what they're saying. You don't need to disagree. Keep the train moving. You don't really understand what the point of the class is. That's okay. Keep the train moving. You know, you've got an interesting story you'd like to share, or you've got the one exception to the rule. Keep the train moving. Don't share it. Whatever, if you're asked a question, give the answer that they're expecting to hear or that they need to hear, because, you know, they've got to get this information across. It doesn't matter if you disagree with it.
Okay, I totally appreciate that. I have a slightly differing perspective, but I'm going to keep the train moving and just move on.
Well done.
And we're moving on to how great Olive Crest is.
Yeah, and this was just a reflection on Olive Crest after the adoption and before we were going to the training. The girls were excited about going to Olive Crest. Mm-hmm. They love going to Olive Crest. And Wendy had written a note to the fine folks at Olive Crest. And what'd you say?
Yeah, this is just, you know, kind of adoption back and forth emails. They were congratulating us. And I said, thank you for your notes. We can hardly believe it's finally done. We felt blessed to have Olive Crest walking with us on our adoption journey. To our kids, a lot of names in the system have become bad words. Their social worker, the judge, the county children's home, the visitation center. But Olive Crest is still a fun and safe name for them. I'm not sure how families elsewhere can handle foster parenting without God and Olive Crest. We're planning to stay certified for the rest of our lives. Good luck trying to get rid of us.
Yeah, thanks for throwing that last part in there about staying certified for the rest of our lives.
Well, this is our calling, right? When you find your calling, you don't just abandon it because you break a hip or something.
Because you break a hip. Yeah, that's my problem with it. The rest of our lives is a long time.
All right, so what's this episode really about, Tim?
What it's really about is we have a friend named Jeremy, mm-hmm. and he's a former roommate of mine, and he used to be a foster child. And he was in town briefly, and we decided to sit him down and get him to talk about his experience as a foster child.
Yeah, so check out the interview of Tim with Jeremy.
I have a friend of mine, Jeremy, here with us, and he is a former roommate, and I didn't know while we were roommates that he was once in foster care, and it was only after Wendy and I became certified that I think he told me, I don't want to call it a dirty little secret, but that part of his past. So welcome to the Foster Parenting Podcast, Jeremy.
Well, thanks, Tim. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Jeremy is currently serving in the U.S. Army in Iraq. And he's on R&R and came through our area while he was here. And we said, hey, we got to get you on the podcast while you're here. We're glad you're here.
Great. Thanks. Always, great to get out to Southern California and then stop and see you when I get the chance.
So, yeah, we appreciate it. Why don't you, let me just give a brief overview of your time in foster care and you can correct anything I got wrong.
Sure.
You and your brother were living with your mom, who was single at the time.
Correct.
And you were in and out a couple of times, and I'm not sure what ages you were when that happened.
Well, there were three times that we were in the system. The first two, I was 11 years old the first time, and then the last time, the second time I was 12 years old, and the third time I was 14.
Okay. And how long were those? How long was each of those detentions?
Sure. The first time was when I was 11, and it was for about 2 months. The second time, so when I was 12, was for about, and that those 2 months were during the summer, so there were different impacts of that versus during the school year. The second time was for about 6 months, and mm-hmm. that included part of the school year, and then that had some significant things we'll probably talk about here. And then the third time was very different from the other two occasions. It was pre-planned. Mm-hmm. My mother was going off to a rehab to work through some of the addiction issues. And it was the whole atmosphere of it going in and coming back was very different because it was pre-planned. The first two events were not pre-planned. And they took place in the midst of some chaos, which had impacts on me and my brother, in terms of how we felt going in and just the whole dynamic of it.
I guess what you're saying is on the first two times, you didn't know it was happening. Just basically the police showed up at your door and took you away.
Well, that first time, I knew mom was struggling with some things. I was the oldest child and we actually went to stay with a relative for a short time. And then from there went to foster care.
Okay.
The second time was, a call where again, my mom dropped us off, with someone. With first a healthcare provider for a day, and then we got transferred to a foster parent, and that was the longer stay.
Hmm. Can you recap kind of what was going on, why they detained you, why the state didn't feel like you were safe?
My mother was going through some issues related to addictions, alcoholism, and depression. And so there were things that came up there that really made it difficult for her to be a functioning parent. There were impacts at home, but then there were a couple occasions where it hit kind of an extreme level where the people she was working with, her health professionals, thought that it was best that we leave her custody. So, and I think those were, looking at it as an adult, I think those were the right calls to make.
Hmm.
And each of those families was pretty different. And each of the experiences was unique.
Okay. That's really interesting. In retrospect, you found it appropriate. I'm sure you didn't at the time. And does your mom, have you talked with your mom about it since then? Has she reflected on it at all?
I mean, we've talked about some of it. I've never gotten anything that says, yeah, we know this was necessary. Cause some of them turned out better than others in terms of the experiences. The third one was clearly one that everybody thinks was positive and necessary. The other two just, they happened because of events and we really didn't have a choice. But, looking at it from my side, yes, that was the best thing for us as the kids.
Hmm. That's a major realization, I'm sure, to kind of wrestle through and come to. That's great that you can look back and see not ideal, but best for the moment.
Well, I mean, there were lots of things, there are certainly happy aspects of my childhood and there were lots of things my mom did right. But there were also some times when looking at it that she just wasn't able to be there in the way that she should have been. And, she certainly would acknowledge that.
Mm.
And you don't put the kids at risk at a certain point, and I think we were at risk at a certain point.
Huh, that's interesting. Tell me about some of your foster parents. Good, bad, ugly?
All three had other kids, and the first family was one that had kids already. And one of the things that was interesting there was that this foster parent made very clear that their kids could do no wrong. In any dispute with their kids, we were automatically wrong.
Hmm.
It was actually the worst by far of the three experiences. The lady did some things that I would consider to be almost abusive themselves.
You had told me this story before, and I thought it was abusive when you told me. Tell them about the cake.
Yes.
Episode.
I had been feeling very sick. I think it was, you know, probably triggered by the events and the anxiety of being kind of yanked out of our home because we didn't know whether, you know, how long we were going to be there. Nobody took us out on that first day and said, you're going out for this reason, for this amount of time, and you're going to see your mom again then. So, you know, I was old enough to remember, you know, 6 years earlier leaving my dad. And so we had mom, and now we don't have mom.
Mm-hmm.
And no clear road for when we're going to get her back and when we're going back. So it was a pretty kind of scary time in terms of what we could expect. And then I have my younger brother as well. And so I was very anxious and often feeling kind of sick to my stomach. And she had made a cake. It was around my birthday time there. And she was insistent, you know, I was feeling sick and couldn't eat it. And she was insistent that I would eat the cake.
Hmm.
And she forced me to eat the cake. And I would be then pretty quickly throwing some of it back up. And she would make me eat more cake, which I would then toss back up as well. I mean, that's something that kind of stuck with me. She didn't always do that kind of thing, but there were a lot of aspects of that home that were very negative.
Mm.
There, so
I think you had told me that they were professing Christians, right?
Yeah, and that's a sad thing. I mean, I'm a Christian person, but the most outspokenly Christian family I had was by far the worst family. And the other two families were not professing Christians. They were very nice, compassionate people. This lady was not.
Yeah. It's I don't want to skirt around that, but I think it's important to point out to other Christians that sometimes we shoot ourselves in the foot. And I think it's God's grace that called you into Christianity despite that experience. Because easily that kind of abuse could have been wrapped into Christianity as the same thing.
Sure.
Tell me about the next family.
Sure. The second family was a set of circumstances where my mom was under pretty extreme stress. She was not able to be the parent, and we transferred to a neighboring school district about 10 miles away from where we lived, but it was a different school district and a fundamentally different kind of town and feel and student population. And that's one thing that I would say you consider when you have kids is if your kids are transferring school systems and the school systems are markedly different, mm-hmm. say one school system has a large minority population and the other one has almost none.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to have impacts on what that kid's school day is like. And even if it's urban versus rural or other things, where did they come from? I know for us, we came from the town school district and went to one that was very rural. The family was very nice and accepting. They had two foster kids, long-term foster kids already. And it was interesting, you know, kind of working out the pecking order with them. They were all older, and I was the firstborn, used to kind of being a second in charge at home.
Hmm.
But the toughest thing there was not the parents, it was the school.
Hmm.
So that was real stressful. Both me and my brother saw our academic performance slip pretty sharply during that time. Then the experience ended during the summer, and we went back to our home original school district for the next year.
Hmm. And you and your brother are half Hispanic.
Right.
Right. So were you feeling racist pressures at the rural school district?
Yes. I mean, I you know, one Latino parent, one Anglo parent, and there for the first time I had been called a dirty spick, for example. And not something I've really had a lot of exposure to. My brother also got a lot of flack. He has a darker complexion than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Most folks think I'm Italian unless they know my last name.
Yeah, since you can't see Jeremy, I'll just tell you that nobody knows he's half Hispanic, and he has a Hispanic last name, and they're like, where did you get that from? Because he doesn't look Hispanic at all. So kids probably intentionally going out of their way to pick up on that difference.
Well, yes, and I thought, well, if you have a problem with me, well, you have a pretty serious problem. But this was a school district that had zero non-white kids. That made the experience tougher, than what we were used to, I think, for both me and my brother.
Hmm. And then the third one, was 2 years later. So from 12 to 14, and it was just for a month, right?
Well, after the second time coming back, I mean, things had gotten progressively more stable. And, one of the next things, in my mom's course of recovery, now she's been dry for 20 years now.
Wow.
So, so very different situation today. But, at that time, the next step was to go to rehab for a month, to work on some things. And it was shared with us in a calm, straightforward manner ahead of time. And we knew who the family was going to be, and we met with them, and, mom got dropped off, and we went and stayed with the family. It just felt very different. Like we were going to stay with people that we just hadn't known first, and then come back from that. They had kids as well. We got along. The lady was a school bus driver. And again, it ended. We picked up mom.
During the school season, or was it during the summer?
It was during the school season, but we were in the same school district. So we had a different bus stop, but we were going to the same schools.
Okay. So you had the same teacher and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Right.
In your first two stays in foster care, were you seeing your mom? Were you having visits with her?
No, we did not see her. There was some communication on the phone.
Okay.
But no, really there was not a lot there. In the first occasion, my dad made contact with us, and he was always a figure that was on the kind of outside of things.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't keep frequent contact with him. But during the second time, some contact with mom on the phone, but there were no in-person visits during those months.
Wow. In the in-between times when you weren't in foster care, were there caseworkers coming over, social workers checking up on you or visiting you?
No, we did have required counseling, family counseling that we went to, all three of us. I remember I hated it because what I was concerned about was that I was going to be – what I would say would be used to take us out of the home again.
Hmm.
So I didn't want to share anything.
Yeah.
And also, one of the people in my school knew, was connected, was a child, one of the staff, and somehow knew I was going to this counseling. So I was embarrassed about it.
Huh. Yeah. That's interesting. You were embarrassed about the counseling. Were you ever embarrassed about the foster care situation, or did other kids know that was going on? Or?
Well, I mean, sure. Certainly I wasn't embarrassed about that. I mean, you just don't like that kind of disruption and having to explain it. And, yeah. some of the people, I never came out and gave an explanation to the class. When I transferred school districts, I'm just transferring school districts, and I didn't say why.
Yeah. I'm moving.
Right.
What kind of, as a former foster kid, what kind of things do you think it's important for foster care or for foster parents to know? Like you said, you had some bad foster parents and some good ones. Like what was kind of the thing that set apart the good ones?
Sure. Well, I think you can be an anchor of stability. If those kids are getting yanked out of their parents' custody, there's a reason. There's some chaos there. There's some situations that may be causing them some fear and anxiety. And so just having a normal kind of situation, things that a lot of us take for granted, normal meal times, normal structure of a home, no random comings and goings at all hours of the day or night, just a standard routine that a lot of people would take for granted in a normal home, that can be kind of an oasis of stability for a little bit.
Mm.
And I think it's important that you don't – in terms of what we had, in terms of our expectations for our reunification with our parent, because it was never the case that we thought we would be taken away permanently. Sometimes there was a fear there, but this was always seen as something for a set period of time until mom was able to take us back.
Hmm.
And so I never even entertained the possibility that we would be pushed out, during the second time that we would be adopted out or never go back. There was some uncertainty that first time. Mm-hmm. And so I'd be careful about that, knowing that those kids have some fear about what's next.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. So your second time was 6 months, and did you know it was going to be about that long, or was it just you knew you'd be returning to your mom, but you didn't know how long it would be?
Correct. Yeah, I did not know how long it would be, but the expectation was that we would return to her after we were done.
Okay. Well, and I'm sure every child has expectation that they'll return, because that's generally the hope.
Right.
When detention first happens. Well, great. Anything else you'd like to add? Or maybe you can tell us, you know, how you feel about the experience now that you're an adult, or what you think of the system. Your final words, basically, is what I'm giving you carte blanche on.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think this presents an enormous opportunity for Christian folks to really reach out to people that need the help. You know, I think these kind of fall into the they're not quite orphans, but they really are the vulnerable in our society. And, you know, the tough thing is also you're not going to see the results of your work. It's too short term most of the time for you to turn around some of the circumstances in these kids' lives or see what happens. And you may not ever know what happens and when they grow up. I actually kept in touch with the second family. Hmm. I've gone and seen them as an adult. They took in a number of other foster kids over their lives. So I think it's an enormously positive way to help kids who are really hurting and just give them a temporary oasis. You know, you're kind of the almost a rest stop in some ways, wherever it is they're headed, whether they're going back to their families or whether they're going to a full-time adoptive situation. So, you know, what you do there matters. And those kids, they've dealt with so much. When you give them something positive for a little bit of time, even though you're not the parent, that can be helpful. You're making the best of a rough situation, because the only other option is that they're without their parent and in a crummy situation.
Hmm. Take advantage of the opportunity for them.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Jeremy. Thanks for sharing and just sharing your story with the rest of the world.
Sure.
Well, first, I guess the first response I want to have is just thanks to Jeremy for, you know, sharing with us and opening up. And, you know, it's interesting that you touched on the part about being embarrassed to be in foster care. I think there's a lot of embarrassment that goes with just being affiliated with the foster care system, regardless of what role you're in. Maybe foster parents have the least of that embarrassment, because most people we know see us in a positive light for what we're doing. But, you know, just that aspect of feeling embarrassed for where you're at, either as the foster child or a parent who's working to reunify with their child. And so I just, want to thank Jeremy for getting, you know, even as there might be a little remnant of that somewhere in him, to be able to get past that and talk about his experience with us.
Yeah. And what I appreciate about Jeremy's story is that it's not foster care wasn't a family death sentence for he and his brother and his mom.
Yes.
You know, she was able to be redeemed. They were reunified.
She was clean. You know, it was like their lives were actually better.
Yeah, and he wasn't in and out for the next 12 years or however much longer his life, you know, his childhood was. It was those few moments, and then they were done.
Mm-hmm. And that is the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah. It's good to hear a positive story.
Yeah.
Well, we've got Listener Corner now.
Listener Corner.
Listener Kim emailed us, and she said, "My question is, we did respite care last weekend for two sisters, ages 1 and 2 years old. And they had clearly been abused by a man. They were terrified of my husband and even the sound of a male voice. My husband literally could not be in the same room as the girls. This left me single parenting all weekend, and of course made my wonderful husband sad. He wanted so much for these girls to know that not all men are bad. Do you or any of your listeners have any advice for this situation? I would like to offer respite care to these girls again, but I need advice." So what say you?
Well, for Kim, I think my first advice is just to be realistic about the fact that it's respite care. And so, you know, just to be realistic that you're not going to be able to turn things around in that short period of time. But that being said, your husband's going to be a piece of the puzzle. You know, they're going to need a lot of positive male influences in their lives in order to to regain a positive viewpoint of a man. So you can, you know, rest assured that him just being there and being positive is going to be
positive in their lives. So despite them being terrified of her husband, he actually does need to assert himself into their caregiving to some degree so that they can know that some men are safe, even if it's terrible for them at the beginning, similar to Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yet, of course, there's going to be things that aren't appropriate for him to do, like change diapers, you know, and be alone in a room.
Holding them for a little bit and letting them scream in terror might be.
But while she's right there next to him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Baby steps.
Use your wisdom in that, I think. And you had this experience not only with our kids who had some kind of male issues coming in, but also with baby Kay, the little girl that we did respite care for a month for, actually emergency placement earlier this year. So,
yeah, she did not like me at all. And that we didn't let that stop us from having me care for her needs and change her diapers and feed her and bathe her and things like that. And she wasn't terrified of me. She just didn't like me. And by the end of the month, she came around and she was okay with it. She wasn't screaming bloody murder the whole time. And that was because I didn't back off from it. I kept doing it. And I think that's kind of what these kids need a little bit sometimes.
Now, the kids that Kim is writing about are 1 and 2. So the needs that you're meeting as a foster father are very basic, but in general, what are some things that you would recommend to men who have children come into their home in this kind of situation, you know, of any age, as far as what you can do and maybe what you did with our girls to be able to attach with them and show them a positive male figure?
Well, first off, be safe. And, you know, eye contact, I think that I always keep that in the back of my head, that develop as much eye contact as possible, because that's where attachment starts and it needs to be rebuilt. Yeah. You know, use your cooing voice, try to be nurturing. Even though maybe it doesn't feel like that's your role or you're just not comfortable with it. Get over it. Mm-hmm. Man up.
Ooh.
Man up and be nurturing.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a bumper sticker.
I think too, you know, if you're going to take these kids for respite again, Kim, you need to think about, how much you can handle. And for me, when we had baby Kay, I threw my back out taking care of her because I was the only one who could, and I have a bad back and there it went. So, you know, we're taking that into consideration as far as doing respite care for babies anymore. And, that would certainly be a factor for us, if I was going to be basically single parenting. And then finally, the advice is with kids of any age, you know, regardless, but definitely when there's issues with men, document as much as you can. You know, it might go into a court case that she's having this kind of reaction to men, and that might be something that they need to know in court later. And then for your sake as well, document and have backup. Always have somebody with you, you know, especially if it's a child who's a little bit older, and just, you know, there's always the fear of false accusations. So just be aware of that and make sure your wife is around. Make sure there's an older kid around, always.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, that's it for today. To leave a comment or ask a question, please visit our website, fosterpodcast.com.
Or send an email to info@fosterpodcast.com. If you like our show, please write a review on iTunes to help others find us.
Names have been changed on this podcast to protect the privacy of those involved.
Foster parenting is the most heart-wrenching, frustrating, all-consuming thing we've ever done.
But when it gets down to it, it's just about helping kids, and that's been the most rewarding thing in our lives.
If you've ever thought you might adopt or foster, we challenge you to take the next step today.